Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Clean power plant planned. Zero emissions project features new technology. Partnering with four major companies, the Durham, North Carolina-based NET Power Incorporated is planning the world's first utility-scale natural gas-fired power plant with nearly zero emissions west of Odessa. Design will start next year for construction to begin in 2024 near Occidental Petroleum's first direct air capture site, said NET Power spokesperson Jeff Phillips. Phillips said Monday that his clean energy technology company is partnering with the Baker Hughes company for key integrated process equipment and technologies. Occidental for CO2 transportation and sequestration and power offtake. Constellation Energy Generation for expertise in plant operations and power offtake. And Eight Rivers Capital for project development support. This is a huge step forward for the clean energy industry and for fighting climate change, helping the world reach net zero emissions by 2050, Phillips said. Our announcement comes 1 year after NET Power's successful sync with the grid from its test facility in La Porte. The project fully integrates power production with transportation and underground sequestration of carbon dioxide, and it targets 300 megawatts of carbon-free power. It will transport captured CO2 to a permanent underground sequestration location through Occidental's existing Permian CO2 handling infrastructure and operations. The project is expected to be online in 2026. La Porte is a suburb of Houston. NET Power CEO Ron DeGregorio said his company's technology will capture nearly all emissions with its patented oxy-fuel combustion and supercritical CO2 cycle. These plants produce clean, on-demand power at low cost and address critical issues of air quality and land use, virtually eliminating air emissions, including nitrogen oxides, sulfur oxides, and carbon dioxide, DeGregorio said in a news release. NET Power proved its groundbreaking technology at its La Porte demonstration site, culminating with synchronization in the Texas electric grid in fall 2021. We announced a partnership with Baker Hughes in February 2022 to develop and market a suite of integrated equipment and technologies, including supercritical CO2 turbo expanders. This utility-scale serial number one project serves as the commercial launch pad for NET Power's core process technology, accelerating other projects already in development and providing the pathway for global deployment of this innovative decarbonization platform. Baker Hughes Chief Technology Officer Chris Barkey said the plant's technology is robust and the program is progressing well to deliver a world-class 300-megawatt class suite of equipment enabling utility-scale operation in 2026 and a rapid ramp-up in commercial deployments thereafter. Obituary. Gary Kellerman, Lubbock, Texas. Gary Kellerman, age 66, of Odessa, Texas, passed away on October 28, 2022, at Covenant Medical Center in Lubbock. Gary was born on February 5, 1956, in Ranger, Texas, and lived most of his life in Odessa, Texas. He graduated from Permian High School and earned his bachelor's degree from Texas Tech University. He is survived by his mother, Priscilla Kellerman, his siblings, David, Jay, and Kathy, his children, Paul Kellerman and wife, Bess, Aaron Falk and husband, Travis, as well as his grandchildren, Jack, Kate, Jordan, Taylor, Xander, and Serena. He is preceded in death by his father, Neil Kellerman. A private memorial service will be held with Gary's immediate family. In lieu of flowers, the family asked that donations be made to Buffalo Trail Scout Ranch or Yellowstone National Park through the National Park Service.
Hello, this is Michael. On this election day, I'm going to read an additional article from a newspaper we don't usually read in this hour. But this particular story does relate to most of the listeners of our radio station at the recording library. This article has to do with being able to vote when a person has a disability. This article is written by the New York Times. New voting laws add difficulties for people with disabilities. Restrictions in several states on mail-in voting are sending more people with disabilities to the polls. What they find isn't always easy to navigate. By Neelam Bora. First, I'm going to describe a photograph at the top of this news article. The picture is of a woman. She looks to be of middle age, has hair just past her shoulders that is kind of a brownish color. She's sitting in a motorized wheelchair, and she is connected to some sort of an oxygen tank. She's wearing glasses. She wears blue pants. She's wearing also dark blue. It looks like some sort of a sweatshirt that is a zipper type sweatshirt that's open. And underneath that sweatshirt, she's wearing a t-shirt that is of a lighter blue. And in white coloring, you can read, "The future is accessibility." She also has an "I voted" sticker on her shirt. Published November 8th. Laura Halverson was ready to vote. On Thursday afternoon, she sat in front of a ballot screen at the IGO Library in San Antonio after spending a month preparing for this moment. It was the first time in years she had been in a public place other than a doctor's office. Sitting in her wheelchair, she wore two masks, one a KN95, the other a part of her breathing machine. Because Ms. Halverson, 38, has muscular dystrophy, a condition that progressively decreases muscle mass and makes her more vulnerable to COVID-19, she needed to use a remote control device supplied by poll workers to make her ballot selections. No one knew how it worked. The glitch was one of many obstacles she had to navigate both on that day and on the previous weeks to fulfill what she saw as her civic duty. For Ms. Halverson and others with disabilities, casting a ballot can always present a challenge. But new voting restrictions enacted in several states over the past 2 years have made it even harder. A law signed last year by Governor Greg Abbott of Texas, a Republican, has made it more difficult for voters to cast ballots by mail and narrowed their options for voting in person, according to groups that advocate for people with disabilities and voting rights. Other Republican-led state legislatures, including in Georgia and Florida, have passed similar measures as a part of what they say are efforts to prevent voter fraud, despite rare occurrences of the crime. Instead of embracing the more accessible forms of voting that sparked record turnout, including among voters with disabilities, said Brian Dimmick, a senior staff attorney for the Disability Rights Program of the American Civil Liberties Union, states have doubled down on new and more restrictive voter suppression laws. None of the new laws single out those with disabilities, but advocates say they have left many people who would otherwise vote by mail with burdensome options, face the greatest risk that their mail-in ballot could be thrown out, as Texas did at a higher than usual rate during the March primary, or go to the polls in person, which involves its own set of inconveniences, or worse, physical barriers, and often deprives people with disabilities of a sense of privacy and independence that other voters can take for granted. Voters with disabilities are being disenfranchised by all these new laws from onerous ID requirements to longer lines, making the entire process less accessible, said Shira Waxlad, the senior director of legal advocacy at the ARC, a disability advocacy organization. Several Texas Republicans who supported the new voting law did not respond to requests for comment about its effect on people with disabilities, although a spokeswoman for Governor Abbott said in a statement that it protects the rights of disabled Texans to request reasonable accommodations or modifications. At a hearing last year, State Senator Brian Hughes, the Texas bill's author, described accommodations for voters with disabilities as potential security risks and said narrowing them would stop others from using those opportunities to cheat. Voting could already be difficult for those with disabilities. About 17.7 million reported voting in the November 2020 election, according to a report by the Program for Disability Research at Rutgers University and the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. 11% of them, or nearly 2 million people, reported that they had some difficulty voting in that election, almost double the rate of people without disabilities. The right to vote privately and independently was enshrined 20 years ago by Congress in the Help America Vote Act, which was the first law to require polling places to have accessible voting systems. The law also established the Federal Election Assistance Commission, an independent body that sets guidelines for states and counties to accommodate disabled voters, which can be enforced by the Justice Department. Despite the law, Thomas Hicks, the commission chairman, said disabled voters still encountered problems, including those who are blind and have trouble locating accessible voting locations, and those who use wheelchairs and need voting machines to be low enough or adjustable to eye level. For Ms. Halverson, a former special education teacher, the difficulties include being able to raise her hands and tap the screen of a voting machine, she said, because of her reduced motor skills. She lives with her partner, accompanied by different caregivers, in a one-story house in San Antonio, and also relies on a breathing machine to survive. A bad case of pneumonia in 2014 weakened her lungs, and she was not able to make a full recovery. Voting by mail made things simpler for her, but after reports that Texas had thrown out more than 18,000 mail-in ballots from its most populous counties during the March primaries, Ms. Halverson, who cannot write on her own and feared having to appeal a rejected ballot, felt she had no other choice but to vote in person. She wanted to see the ballot go in herself, she said, even if it meant risking her health. This election is too important to wait to find out if my vote counted, she said. A week of research about voting in person led Ms. Halverson to a new kind of machine that Texas had recently put in place, allowing a remote to be connected to the screen and used to make selections. She called her county clerk to ensure those machines would be present at the IGO library, her polling place. She did not hear back, she said. Lydia Nunez Landry, a disability rights activist in Houston who has a different form of muscular dystrophy, said her experience using the remote on the first day of early voting went so poorly, including a poll worker seeing Ms. Landry's chosen candidates, that she immediately filed a complaint with the Justice Department. I'm just so angry, Ms. Landry said. They constantly are changing things. It feels like, to the disability community, we're just so confused. Ms. Halverson wanted a caregiver to accompany her to the polling place in case she had a similar experience and needed help. She also scheduled a coronavirus vaccine booster shot exactly 2 weeks before the end of early voting. On Thursday morning, Ms. Halverson viewed an online guide to the candidates one more time. Her former service dog, Houston, wagged his tail as he put his paws in her lap and begged for treats. She drove to the library with one of her daytime caregivers, Shaylin Lewis, in a large orange wheelchair-accessible van. A parking spot for the disabled was available, which often is not the case, Ms. Halverson said. Then it was time to take an inventory. Ms. Halverson ticked off aloud what to bring inside. Phone, identification, water bottle, hand sanitizer and wipes, and the absentee ballot she needed to turn in. Inside the library, a voting clerk wearing a U.S. Marine Corps veteran cap waved people through to the polling room. Ms. Halverson and her caregiver entered and waited in line to turn in the absentee ballot and receive a remote. Ms. Halverson later said her heart was beating out of her chest as she saw all the people around her without masks on in such close quarters. After securing the remote and pulling in front of a voting machine, she began trying to click through on the side buttons, but the screen did not respond. She said she asked for help, but none of the workers seemed to know how it worked either. After a few tries, she said, the up and down buttons on the remote made the screen respond. It was still hard to read, however, as the font seemed to be enlarged and cut off the party affiliations for candidates she didn't know. The Bexar County Elections Administrator, Jacqueline Callahan, did not respond to requests for comment about Ms. Halverson's voting experience. While at least 24 people entered and exited the voting area within minutes, Ms. Halverson remained inside, trying to navigate the machine. After about half an hour, she was able to deposit her ballot. Later, she said she felt fortunate that her experience was not worse. Still, she said, it should be smooth for literally everybody. Before Ms. Halverson left, one observer acknowledged her efforts. The man gave me 2 I voted stickers, she said. He said it's because I had to go through twice as much as everybody else. Ava Sasani contributed reporting.
Hello, friends. This is Julie, reading from the Odessa American, November 6, 2022. City Council has busy Tuesday agenda by Kim Smith. Thanks to a stringent standard put into place by China and India, recycling isn't nearly as profitable as it once was, and it appears as though the city of Odessa will soon be losing 326 recycling bins as a result. Last week, Utilities Director Tom Kerr told council members BRI Recycling Services, which has had a contract with the city for roughly 20 years, was unwilling to continue processing the recyclables from the 300-plus bins placed around the city at schools and commercial businesses like DK's convenience store. He also told the council BRI is raising its rates. They advise us that the waste percentage in the commercial pickup was just too much for their consideration to process, Kerr told the council. Roughly 50% of the materials in the recycling bin is contaminated, Kerr said. In 2018, China decided it wouldn't accept materials unless the contamination rate was 0.5%. Up until that point, for 40% of the United States, paper, plastic, and other recyclables went to China. India, too, has tightened its standards. For example, it has a 1% contamination rate on mixed paper imports. According to Kerr, the city current disposals roughly 100,000 tons of garbage a year and about 700 tons of recyclables. Knowing that BRI's contract ends in January, Kerr told the council he sent out a request for proposals, but BRI is the only company that responded. As a result, he said the council has 4 options to choose from. If the council wants to maintain the current contract with BRI, minus the 326 bins, it will cost the city $96,000 a year instead of the current $60,000 price tag, Kerr said. The city will continue to pick up the recyclables at the city's 7 collection sites and the time machine, and BRI employees would continue to separate trash from the recyclables on city property on 42nd Street. The second option would involve the city continuing to bring everything to the 42nd Street facility, but the BRI would take the separate materials at the company facility in Midland. The price tag, $276,000. The third option would be for BRI to pick up the bins at the seven collectible sites and the time machine, hauling the materials to Midland and separating it there. Kerr said the total cost, $354,000. The fourth option is to stop recycling completely. The problem with the $96,000 option is that the city would save roughly $68,000 a year, but would have to replace the building where the separating takes place at a cost of $1.85 million, Kerr said. The 16,000-square-foot building is in terrible condition. All the city council members indicated they were inclined to go through the third option, where BRI would start picking up and hauling the materials to Midland. They vote on the matter Tuesday night. Kerr predicted 70% of the school and commercial business using the recycling bins will replace them with trash bins, bringing in an additional $243,000 in revenue annually. They are currently paying $33 a month for the recycling bins, and the trash bins cost $86 a month, he said. Taking into consideration other expenses and cost savings, Kerr said the city has to increase its budget by $149,766 if the council chooses three options. If the city council chooses the second option and continues to haul everything to 42nd Street itself, the city would have an increased budget by just under $112,000. Stopping recycling completely would save the city over $164,000. In other matters, the City Council will consider awarding KDC Associates, a Midland company, a $650,000 contract to redesign and oversee downtown improvement projects. Kelly Cook, a partner at the firm, and Casey Hallmark, Downtown Odessa Executive Director, told the council last week KDC looked at the downtown to see where an entertainment district could be located and where the city could get the budget impact for the $7 million it issued in certificates of obligation 3 years ago. Cook provided the council with artist renderings of Jackson Avenue, but noted no location has been set in stone. They're suggesting Jackson Avenue because the project could take 6 months to 2 years and fewer businesses would be disrupted. There would be immediate changes taxpayers could see. It would link to public-private partnership projects that are already finished, and there'd be fewer interactions between pedestrians and vehicles. Cook and Hallmark said prior to the start of the project, KDC would engage business members of the public and the city council in discussions about the entertainment district's features. ExxonMobil marks record in basin. CO2 capture deal announced by company leader, by Bob Campbell. The ExxonMobil Corp has a strong third quarter earnings of $19.7 billion and hitting record production in the Permian Basin with 560,000 barrels of oil per day. We signed a largest of its kind commercial agreement to capture and permanently store up to 2 million metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions per year, reported Chairman CEO Darren Woods from Irving. Northwest of Dallas, there are others pulled back in the face of uncertainty and a historic slowdown, retreating and retrenching. This company moved forward, continuing to invest and build. Higher natural gas realizations, strong refineries, Thorough put, robust refining margins, and a rigorous cost control drove our earnings improvement. Wood said ExxonMobil continues to make progress on the Beaumont refinery expansion, which will increase capacity by about 250,000 barrels per day in the first quarter of 2023. We also increased production from our high-return assets in the Permian and Guyana, he said. We grew our production in Guyana at 360,000 barrels per day for the third quarter. In October, Wood said his company achieved its first liquefied natural gas production from Mozambique Coral South Floating LNG development. We continue to actively manage our portfolio, announcing the sale of our interest in Arrow Oil production operating in California and our refinery in Billings, Montana, he said. Proceeds from divestments completed year-to-date totaled $4 billion as we captured incremental value of these non-core assets in today's higher-priced environment. Wood said Russia has terminated ExxonMobil's interest in the Sakhalin 1 project and given it to Russian company. In March, we started our intention to exit
Sakhalin 1 and discontinue our role as operator, and we took an impairment of approximately $3.4 billion at the time. While our affiliate was in force majeure due to its unprecedented impact of global sanctions, we continue to make every attempt to engage in good faith discussions with the Russian government and all Sakhalin 1 partners to effect a smooth exit to the benefit of all parties. A force majeure is a provision in a contract that frees both parties from obligations if an extraordinary event directly prevents one of both parties from performing. Noting that the natural gas prices rose to record levels in the third quarter, but have recently moderated, Wood said there's been a lot of concern in Europe about the withdrawal of Russian supply and efforts to build inventory ahead of winter. We've continued to actively manage our portfolio, closing the sale of our Romanian upstream affiliate and XTO Energy Canada, he said. Chief Financial Officer Kathy McHales said in reference to the amounts of oil and gas and refined products her company produced, we had across the globe the best results to put through that we've seen since 2008. McHales said the demand for gasoline was lower than usual last summer, but the demand for diesel fuel remained strong. We did a good job on revenue management and saw positive benefits there, she said. Basin PBS to launch Lounge at Airport by Ruth Campbell. Midland Basin PBS is creating a lounge that is likely the first of its kind at the Midland International Air and Spaceport. The target opening time is January 2023. General Manager, CEO, Laura Wolf said it's a joint effort between Permian Resources, Permian PBS, and Midland International Air and Spaceport. The lounge will access from the Southwest Airlines gate. There will be a big couch for parents to sit on, and an iPad table that will feature only PBS Kids and PBS Learning Media. Wolf and Allison Trevino said, who does relations for the station, said, it includes PBS Kids videos with Daniel Teeger and Pickleacious and PBS Kids games. There's four of those. It's restricted to access only, so that's all they'll be able to get into. It's going to have a big, giant TV, and we'll play PBS Kids 24/7 on it. We've got a free little library where kids can take a book to take on the plane. They don't have to return it, Wolf said. Trevino said there will be a reading nook and a huge, cute bookshelf to house it in. Wolf added there will be a busy board shaped like an airplane mounted on the wall. There are five panels on it. I believe at least one activity on each one, Trevino said. There'll be a clock where children can change the time. There are pieces they can move around on a little maze area and beads on a wire and things like that. So it's an active place for kids to go and play, he said. Wolf said the area will be for pre-kindergartens through third grade, but they're going to put in some chapter books for older children to take. Wolf and Trevino said the area will be decorated in PBS blue and green and have Daniel Teeger's chairs. You'll definitely want to know where you are, Trevino said. It's roughly 209 inches by 100-inch space, and PBS has a 5-year contract with the airport. PBS Kids is a huge part of families' lives. I think all kids from even my age to yours, Mr. Rogers, Sesame Street, with School of Rock, throughout the years, PBS Kids have really been instrumental in developing children's minds, especially socially and emotionally. It's wonderful that we can now take this to the Midland International Air and Space Force to give those kids the experience of what PBS Kids is all about, Wolf said. Wolf noted that Colgate Energy helped out a great deal. With this comes a ton of hard cost. We have to buy all the furniture, all the books. We have to make sure everything's industrial strength because of the wear and tear and the Elba Airport charge for space. So without Colgate Energy, we wouldn't have been able to do this, and their commitment to kids in our area is pretty overwhelming. The concept came about a year and a half ago when we were talking about ideas. We were like, we can be out there and not just the board, and there's nothing for kids, so it's sort of, hey, wouldn't it be neat movement, Trevino said. Wolf said they'd been working on the project for about a year. She added that she didn't want to announce it until they got funding and the ballpark timeline established. They had to get contracts and permission from Fred Rogers Production, for example. They're working on some other permissions as well. Supply chains have been an issue. The furniture is being built, but the books and busy bards are in. Books will be replenished once a week, and the lounge will be cleaned regularly. Trevino said the lounge will be a safe place where they can rest, wait, and relax. Wolf said it will also keep children out of the harm's way. The airport website says it's more than 20 departures a day. The daily average for the last 12 months is about 1,700 passengers per day. The airport has more than 605,000 total emplanements from October 1st, 2021 to September 30th of this year. PBS executives expect the lounge to attract about 70% of the airport traffic. It's also a kind of joy that a kid can get a book and take it on the plane and keep it, Wolf said. Trevino said it will be also keep children busy, and it takes PBS kids and PBS across the state and nation. The median age in Midland is now 34, so there are a lot of kids, and they're coming in and living here, and this introduces them to who we are, Wolf said. In the 4 years she's been with Permian PBS, Wolf says it is probably the project she's most proud of, if not only based in PBS, but her career. Because it's lasting, it's going to make a difference in people's lives. Even if it's small difference, even if it alleviates a little stress at the airport, that's a big deal. Kids are hard, Wolf said. John Pulig, the new education director at Basin PBB, has been on the job about 4 months. I grew up out here in the Permian Basin area. I'm from Big Lake, so I've been in and out of Midland my whole life. I was a teacher and a coach, taught 8th grade social studies, and coached all the junior high sports, Pulig said. She was in Big Lake for about 3 years and was going to move to Midland. This job was available, and so I applied, and here I am, Pulig said. I'm really excited about all the things that PBS has to offer and the growth that's happening here. There's a lot going on at PBS, and especially the station has a lot going on all the time. We've gotten to do a back-to-school festival for the kids. We're working on an intercession camp in a couple of weeks. We'll be having De La Zavala Elementary in Midland. It's never a dull moment. It's happening. In between all of that, we've got the airport project and getting to know the community a little bit better. Obituaries. El Paso. Robert Barb Carlos Heron, 84, of Gafford, Texas, was born August 17, 1938, in Strawn, Texas, to parents Mickey and Tina Heron. Bob graduated as valedictorian from Strong High School. Having a young, adventurous spirit, he enlisted in the U.S. Marine Corps immediately following graduation. He was a lifelong proud Marine and proud to serve his country. After the Marines, Bob continued his career with British Petroleum, which took him around the world by traveling and working in over 50 countries. Being an avid fisherman and hunter, Bob and his wife, Darlene, enjoyed retirement at Possum Kingdom Lake and Ruidosa. A celebration of life will be held at Crossroads Church in Odessa, Texas, on November 9th at 11 a.m., with lunch to follow. Warshaw, Illinois. Ruby Jean Bolton, 79, of Warshaw, Illinois, passed away on Wednesday, November 2nd, at Oak Lane Nursing and Rehab in Stronghurst, Illinois. Ruby was born on January 25, 1943, in Arp, Texas, the daughter of Earl Roy and Irma Pettis Heron. She graduated from Ector High School in Odessa in 1963. On March 14, 1964, she was united in marriage to Bill Bolton. They are divorced in 1977. Ruby was employed in food services for nursing homes and school systems throughout her working career. She belonged to the Baptist Church and enjoyed spending her free time eating out at new places, car rides, riding her bike, feeding ducks, and being in nature. Camping, arrowhead hunting, and viewing rock formations were some of the outdoor experiences she cherished. Ruby loved watching her old westerns, especially ones featuring John Wayne and Clint Eastwood. She was the family historian and loved driving back to Texas to spend time with her family. Her family was her top priority. A celebration of her life will be held at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the Alzheimer's Association or the Canuck Humane Society. Printy Funeral Home of Warshaw, Illinois is in charge of arrangements.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, November 7th. ECIST sets GT Super Saturday, event aimed at showcasing gifted and talented programs. In an effort to let the community, teachers, and parents know what's going on in the gifted and talented world, Ector County ISD will host ECISD GT Super Saturday from 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. November 12th. The event will be at Blackshear Elementary School, 501 South Dixie Boulevard. The event will be in English and Spanish, and they will each have keynote speakers. For the English part, it is Kathy Koch, an author and founder of Celebrate Kids Incorporated and co-founder of Ignite the Family. Lizeth Seja Prado, a multimedia journalist at CBS7 and Telemundo, will be speaker for the Spanish portion. Quote, "We wanted to have an opportunity to get our students together with the GT teachers outside of school, which is part of the state plan, is that there's opportunities for students to engage in gifted activities outside of the school day," Director of Advanced Academic Services Kristen Veasley said. She added that they wanted teachers to have an opportunity to get their required 6-hour training update all at once. They also decided to have Super Saturday in English and Spanish and make sure parents and the community got a chance to engage with GT, the teachers and staff, and other aspects. Quote, "We really are trying to build those connections. The goal is to build an advocacy for gifted and talented education in ECISD. We've also invited districts in the surrounding area to come, and so hopefully, several years down the line, maybe we'll have a larger group where the school districts and communities from several different places come together, and we can work to make gifted education better for all students," Veasley said. The goal is for parents to see how the gifted program works for students in elementary school and what the next steps look like through middle and high school and on to college. Quote, "We're really kind of working it as an advisory for parents at the same time, as it's an opportunity for our students who are playing with the GT teachers in a kind of a mini-camp SIP environment, so they get to pick their passion of 4 different strands. They get to pick the one they like best, and then they'll be working with the GT teacher all day in that strand of whether it's creativity, science, technology," she added. SIP stands for Scholars in Progress. English and Spanish speakers will start together in a bilingual fashion and then separate as they will come back together in the last hour, Beasley said. Chief Communications Officer Mike Adkins will moderate a GT panel starting at around 2:45 p.m. Some on the panel will speak English and some Spanish, she said. Elementary Coordinator for Advanced Academic Services Stephanie Wright said Koch has written 6+ books, and she'll have books for sale at the conference. Feasley said Prado has had a really neat story about becoming an educated woman and following her dreams and her passions. "We're super excited to have both of them," Feasley said. The conference is free, and there will be door prizes and giveaways. Different departments at ECISD will have tables to share information and resources. Wright said UTPB will attend to talk about the Falcon Free Scholarship. Quote, "We're just kind of trying to make it a community event as much as we can," Beasley said. Cultural Pride. Professor, grad student, spotlight importance of mariachi. The story was written by Kay Richter. A University of Texas Permian Basin professor and a graduate student want to show the world what mariachi means to Hispanic culture and identity. Quote, "We actually want to make sure that our students feel proud of who they are," Tomas Espinoza, assistant professor of ESL, Bilingual Education, said. Espinosa and Monica Cantu, who is working toward a master's in business administration, have presented their study locally, nationally, and internationally through organizations like the National Association for Bilingual Education. Cantu said many people moved to Odessa because of the number of Hispanics. Quote, one of my friends moved to West Texas State University, which is in Canyon. He decided to come back here to UTPB because he didn't identify with people in the panhandle, Cantu said. Continuing the quote, he did not feel comfortable surrounded by people who do not speak the same language as him or have the same similarities in the way of thinking or because of the type of culture as well. I'm a Mexican-American, and I would love to contribute to show how important it is for people to show their culture and wherever they're standing at the end of the day, Cantu said. Quote, we tend to embrace our culture by helping others and cooperating with whatever we can at the end of the day, but also we're embracing our past and knowing our roots, she added. Hispanic people should be proud of their heritage and carry it with them wherever they go. At UTPB, Espinosa said they're big on making sure that students feel included. Getting involved in activities outside of class also helps students network. Quote, diversity is one of our strengths. Sometimes these students feel that because they come from a different background or they come from a different culture, sometimes they feel like they don't belong. But I always emphasize this with my students because I teach a bilingual education. I tell them, you have to be proud of who you are, Espinosa said. By being proud of your culture and even being bilingual, you will be able to speak different languages. That opens the doors for more opportunities for you. It has a lot of benefits socially, professionally, and even culturally, he added. Cantu said Espinosa asked her to do some research about mariachi. She was eager to jump on board. She added that she wanted to represent the culture and embrace it. She said it would help students understand the importance of mariachi, the role it plays in Hispanic culture, and how it could help educators see the value of music and arts. When people see you dressed in certain clothing or hats, they know it's from Mexico, but they may not know the history, what it involves, the songs, the music, and the traditions. Quote, I was not aware of specific details that now I'm more into, so that's why we're excited to do the research and promote it to other people, Cantu said. Clothing and color can also represent regions in terms of culture. She has also been researching ballet folklorico. Espinosa said when people wear the mariachi apparel and hats, they feel powerful and really connected to their culture. Cantu will be presenting on ballet folklorico at a conference in Oregon. She has learned a lot about it as well in her research. Espinosa said their avocation can become not only part of their lives, but a profession. Quote, some of the girls told me, oh yeah, I've been dancing since I was like 3 or 5. I was like, you're 20. Wow, that's amazing. They were happy that they were able to do it since they were little, and then they went to college, and the university has the program here, and they were able to continue doing that, Cantu said.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading a couple of articles from the inside pages of the Odessa American from Monday, November 7th, 2022. Man Turns Himself In Following Shooting by Kim Smith. A friend of the two men who were shot outside Pat's Place Friday night told deputies they were ambushed, but Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths said Sunday night his investigators are considering all scenarios, including one in which the suspects were in the wrong bar at the wrong time. Multiple types of shell casings were found at the scene, and investigators will be speaking with additional people in the next couple of days, Griffiths said. There's a chance the shooting could have been justified, but that will likely be up to a jury to decide, he said. There could be more charges on both sides. We just don't know at this point, Griffiths said. According to the arrest affidavit, deputies were dispatched to the bar in the 7400 block of Andrews Highway around 11:30 p.m. Friday about a shooting. When they arrived, they found Aaron Ramos, 27, dead, and a 25-year-old man badly injured. The vice president of the Cossacks Motorcycle Club told deputies a man named Minto was kicked out of the bar, and a few minutes later, he was informed he was being asked for by a group of people who were causing problems outside, the report stated. The vice president told deputies when he and some of the club members went outside, a man authorities later identified as Nicholas James Thompson, 41, stepped out of a black car and fired roughly 15 rounds toward the club members, the report stated. The vice president said he took cover, but quickly learned two club members had been struck by gunfire, the report stated. When the car sped away, the man said he saw Minto in the passenger seat, according to the report. During the ensuing investigation, Thompson called the authorities and said he knew they were looking for him and his car was in his garage with bullet holes, the report stated. According to the Odessa Police Department, Thompson turned himself over to their crisis negotiation and SWAT teams around 6:30 a.m. Saturday in the 7200 block of Cross B. Thompson was booked into the Ector County Jail on suspicion of murder, and his bond has been set at $350,000. Griffiths said investigators have been in touch with Minto and hope to interview him Monday. Initially, investigators thought the argument may have been over a woman, but they no longer believe that, Griffiths said. It could be that Thompson and Minto were in the wrong bar at the wrong time, but that remains unknown at this time, he said. Griffiths said Sunday night he didn't know the latest condition of the other gunshot victim. Is Medicare annual enrollment time for me? By Tony King. Dear Tony, I turned 65 in April and am overwhelmed by all the mail I'm getting this year for Medicare annual enrollment. What do I do? The mail from company says theirs is the best, but they all offer the same thing with dental, vision, and gym membership. One Medicare Advantage commercial on TV says that they can put money back into your Social Security check. I am not receiving my Social Security check and wonder how I can get the money. If I do not enroll in Medicare at the right time, everybody says I will get a penalty that will last the rest of my life. How does someone know what is the right decision for their situation? Look forward to your answer. Nathan from Nashville, Tennessee. Dear Nathan, the answer to your question is that you need to do nothing, nada, during the Medicare annual enrollment period because you are not 65 yet and have not enrolled in Medicare. Next year's Medicare annual enrollment period is when you can make a change to your Medicare Part D plan, change or enroll in a Medicare Advantage plan with or without a Medicare Part D prescription drug plan. Medicare annual enrollment period is discussed in detail in Chapter 6 of the Medicare Survival Guide Advanced Edition. You must have already turned 65 or be under 65 and enrolled in Medicare to change or enroll in a Medicare Part D prescription drug plan or a Medicare Advantage plan during Medicare's annual enrollment period. You are turning 65 in April and will be in your Medicare initial enrollment period, which is a 7-month period that will begin 3 months prior to April, the month of April and 3 months after. So January would be a good time to begin enrolling in Medicare and exploring which Medicare option best fits your specific medical and prescription drug needs. Always talk with your Medicare provider to learn what type of Medicare plan, whether Medicare Advantage plan with prescription drug plan, or original traditional Medicare with a Medicare supplement and a standalone Medicare Part D plan, is right for your health situation and the prescriptions you are currently taking. As we say at the Tony Says office, Medicare is not a cookie cutter. One size or one plan does not fit everyone. The insurance companies market their specific Medicare plans and want you to believe that theirs is perfect for you. America should be aware of friendly telemarketers that try and change one's Medicare plan options during Medicare's enrollment annual period. Please be careful giving out personal information to strangers over the phone. Telemarketers are lurking around like a lion, waiting for the right person to attack when those confused only need proper Medicare information to help them make the right Medicare decision. There are specific Medicare rules when changing from a Medicare Advantage plan to a Medicare supplement. Please be aware that you will have to answer underwriting questions. To learn how to personalize your Medicare to meet your needs, attend the Confused About Medicare Zoom webinar from 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, November 16th. Visit www.TonySays.com for the registration link. Tony Says Alert. Medicare annual enrollment period is for those who are already enrolled in Medicare. You do not have to make a change during the Medicare's annual enrollment period if you are pleased with your current plan, such as Medicare Advantage Plan, Medicare Part D Prescription Drug Plan, or Medicare Supplement. More Medicare and Boomer Senior information and podcasts are available at www.seniorsource.com. For answers to your Medicare questions and concerns, call the Tony Says Medicare team at 832-519-8664 or email info@TonySays.com.
Hi, this is Denisa reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, November 8th, 2022. Dear Abby, divorce is still a raw subject after 10 plus years. Dear Abby, my parents were married for 22 years. They separated in 2007, and by 2008, the divorce was final. While this was a good thing for both of them, the fallout from their marriage was intense. I won't dig into the ugly details, but they both had their faults, and it was rough. Since the divorce, Dad has moved on. Sadly, he lost his wife of 13 years suddenly several months ago. Mom still blames Dad for every bad thing that has happened to her since the divorce, even though she chose to quit her job and go on disability, which severely limited her income and options. When Dad's wife died, Mom was almost happy. She said she knew that same grief because of what she went through with the divorce. It's not the same thing. I would like to invite Dad to holiday gatherings with the family this year, as he will be alone most of the time. But Mom refuses to come if he is there. How can I help her move on? Inclusive in Michigan. Dear Inclusive, remember the adage, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink? All these years, your mother has nursed her anger as though it was an infant. The only person who can help her move on is herself, which she is clearly unwilling to do. Ask your father how he would feel about joining the family during the coming holidays. You may find that he would prefer to avoid her and socialize with friends he and his wife cultivated during their marriage. But please do not allow your mother to dictate whom you can or cannot entertain in your home. If she wishes to stay away, that will be her privilege and her punishment. Dear Abby, my husband is hard of hearing. No matter what I ask of him or when we have a conversation, he denies I ever spoke to him, ask him to do anything, etc. When I suggest that he may have a hearing problem and should see a doctor, he becomes angry, belligerent, and denies there's anything wrong with him. Our marriage has turned into one big fight. I have asked him to say, "I didn't hear you. Could you repeat that?" when he doesn't hear me, but that hasn't worked. He still flat out denies that I said anything to him. If I don't hear him clearly, I ask him to repeat what I didn't hear. How can I convince him that he needs a hearing aid before these fights end our marriage? On deaf ears in West Virginia. Dear ODE, this is a problem you both should discuss with your husband's doctor, preferably before his next physical. Sadly, his denial is shared by many who equate hearing loss with something to be embarrassed about. I can suggest a Band-Aid in the meantime, but without intervention, your husband's problem will progress and he will find himself increasingly socially isolated. For now, if you want his attention, touch his arm or shoulder before asking him a question. That way, he will have to pay attention.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.